dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been my distinct privilege and high honor to have come to know and admire greatly a man who I think has served with great distinction in the course of that war for the free world, at least the present phases of it. His name is Dr. Colonel Lawrence Sullen, United States Army Reserves retired. He has been both a distinguished Army officer, he has been a clinical scientist, he has been a veteran of combat operations in Afghanistan and Iraq. He has subsequently served in business and been an extraordinarily prolific contributor to public policy debates, both involving Afghanistan and what we should be doing about it and the various adversaries we face there, both in country and those trying to influence it from outside the country. He has also, very importantly, tackled COVID-19, its sources, the nature of the Chinese Communist Party biological warfare program from which it emanated, he believes. We'll get into all of that with him in the course of this hour, I'm pleased to say. And let me just also say, welcome, Colonel Dr. Sullen. It's always good to have you with us, and I especially appreciate you visiting with us at length today.
Yes, thank you for inviting me to your program, Frank.
It's always a pleasure. Let me start with Afghanistan. As I say, you served there. You have followed closely both of course, during your time in country, but also in the years since. The veil of tears, I guess one might call it, of our engagement in that country and the lack of strategic clarity about, well, I think that is both the nature of the enemy and what needed to be done to defeat it. Give us sort of a 30,000-foot level assessment of what went wrong in Afghanistan, and then we'll talk about where we find ourselves now after Joe Biden's humiliating strategic defeat there.
Well, in my opinion, Frank, we were fighting the wrong war in Afghanistan. It was being fought as a counterinsurgency operation when it was actually a proxy war being waged by Pakistan against Afghanistan and the United States using the Taliban. It was always been remarkable to me, having been there twice, is that that fact was either not recognized or ignored, because it was clear from the very beginning that Pakistan was harboring the Taliban, and also Al-Qaeda for that matter, and that the Taliban had a huge infrastructure inside Pakistan, which involved recruitment and training and rest and recuperation and hospitalization. And these essentially bases and command and control centers, of which there were four inside Pakistan, were never attacked by the United States or Afghanistan. So the Taliban essentially had a sanctuary in Pakistan and were able to move freely back and forth and had direct support from the Pakistani government, in particular the Pakistani intelligence agency. So I think at a high level, that is essentially why we lost the war in Afghanistan, because we never recognized the true enemy and addressed it properly.
It's a very important point, and it is reminiscent of a mistake that we made to some extent in Vietnam as well, with the degree of support that the Vietnamese, Viet Cong, were able to, the North Vietnamese, that is, Viet Cong were able to obtain from, you know, the Ho Chi Minh Trail and the ancillary operations in Cambodia and Laos that made that war much more difficult to prosecute. But what you say of what happened with Pakistan is made even more ironic by the fact that, as Laura Logan has been pointing out rather vehemently, we were paying the Pakistanis, their military and their intelligence services, much if not virtually all of their budget. And for them to be engaging in this kind of betrayal murderously was simply scandalous, was it not?
Well, yes, indeed. We were, in fact, paying the Pakistanis, and they were using that money to fund the Taliban. And not only that, the Pakistanis were involved in drug trafficking from Afghanistan into Pakistan and then out through the Pakistani ports to the rest of the world. So the Taliban was funding, and the Pakistanis were funding Taliban operations in Afghanistan through drug trafficking. So it's even worse than simply giving money from the United States to Pakistan, which is bad enough, which ended up killing and wounding our troops.
There were several things contributing to this, of course. One was the simple logistical reality that much of what we needed to prosecute that conflict had to come overland through Pakistan, or so we were told. And secondly, that we had kind of going back to the days of the Soviet engagement in Afghanistan and our support for the Mujahideen fighting them, that we essentially contracted that out to Pakistan's intelligence services, the ISI, did we not?
Yeah, you're exactly right, Frank, and that's a very important point because this started during the battle over the Soviet occupation in Afghanistan, where the CIA, in fact, outsourced the funding and supply to the Mujahideen, to the Pakistani intelligence agencies. And what the ISI did, the Pakistani intelligence agency, what they did was fund the groups that were pro-Pakistan and essentially ignored the groups that were Afghan nationalists. So it directly led at the time of the Soviet withdrawal to the rise of groups within Afghanistan that were pro-Pakistani, in particular the Taliban, which actually was a creation of the Pakistani intelligence agency. So this started very early on. This kind of neglect of the strategic situation started very early and simply progressed into our recent involvement in Afghanistan.
To the extent that we wound up being betrayed by the Pakistanis and we simultaneously had these problems, historical as well as, you know, the ongoing dependency on safe passage, more or less, through Pakistan for our military resupply convoys. You have argued for some time, and most recently in a piece at Chanakya Forum, about a soft underbelly of Pakistan that we might have used to either defeat what the Pakistanis were doing to subvert us, to support the Taliban and otherwise enable the bloodletting of Americans and our Afghan allies in a place called Balochistan. Talk a little bit about that region and its relationship with Pakistan more generally, and your thoughts on what might have been done, and more to the point, what should be done now.
Yes, you're right. Balochistan was not only important during our involvement in Afghanistan, but is actually become a center of gravity in terms of the future, especially in regard to the Chinese, China-Pakistan-Taliban alliance, which is now developing in South Asia. Now, Balochistan is the westernmost province of Pakistan. It is on the strategically important Arabian Sea, and to the west is Iran, and of course to the north is Afghanistan. Now, since the independence of Pakistan in 1948, there's been a festering independence insurgency in Balochistan, because what the Pakistanis did was At that time, Balochistan was independent and chose independence, but the Pakistani army essentially invaded and incorporated Balochistan into Pakistan by force. And this festering insurgency has been going on since 1948, essentially. So the Baluchis have always wanted to be independent. They're traditionally secular and tolerant, which goes against the Islamist emphasis in Pakistan and would be advantageous. It would also would have provided, as an independent country, a safe route to Afghanistan from the sea and give Afghanistan a friendly neighbor. So that's historically what we could have done if we had put some pressure on Pakistan via the Balochistan independence movement. Now it has become even more important from the standpoint that China seeks to dominate economically and militarily South Asia, which is step towards, in their view, global superpower status. So the economic vehicle to achieve that global dominance is the Belt and Road Initiative, which is a collection of infrastructure projects and a network of commercial agreements, which is really designed to link the entire world to the Chinese economy. And that is often followed by the establishment of military bases by China. Now, the economic portion of the Belt and Road Initiative in Pakistan is called the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is a backbone of transportation networks which connects China to the Pakistani Arabian seaports of Karachi in the east and Gwadar in the west, which is in Balochistan. So the success of China's both economic and military ambitions in South Asia depend on Balochistan, because China would like to establish military bases in that Gwadar area, which is close to the Iranian border and the mouth of the Persian Gulf, which is, of course, a critical sea lane and also connects to China's new military base in Djibouti, which is at another choke point at the entrance of the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. So Balochistan has become even more a critical center of gravity in terms of preventing Chinese domination of South Asia.
You've laid a very rich table there. There's a lot of things to drill down on, and let me just say at the outset, one of the things that I prize about you and about our conversations is the sort of strategic vision and acumen that you bring to bear on these things. The Belt and Road Initiative is something we've talked about on this program frequently. It is the subject of a report of our Committee on the Present Danger of China and the Captive Nations Coalition that we call China's Dream, the World's Nightmare. And people can find this online at presentdangerchina.org. But it makes the point kind of globally that you've just made in this particular and very, very important strategic context, Colonel Sellin, namely that China is using this so-called Belt and Road colonial empire building scheme to establish both economic relationships, what you call economic soft power, and the hard power infrastructure of, you know, the People's Liberation Army and its ability to project that power throughout the world. You've also introduced the thought about choke points and places where the Chinese want to be able to control shipping or important air lanes, perhaps. And all of this, it seems to me, is vitally important to our understanding of the nature of the enemy we're up against in the Chinese Communist Party. You say we got it wrong in Afghanistan. We're getting it even wronger, if I can use that expression, with respect to the CCP, it seems. So again, if you would just put these sort of initiatives in Pakistan and Balochistan into that larger context, what is China up to, as you see it, beyond South Asia, that should be of great concern to us as well?
Well, first of all, the economic expansion through the Belt and Road Initiative is always linked to military expansion. So China always tries to establish military bases or military capabilities in these places where they're also establishing these economic initiatives. And this is not speculation on my part. It is actually spelled out in a white paper on China's military strategy, and they call it open seas protection. So it's a justification for them to give follow-on military capability in the areas where they're establishing these economic zones, so to speak. And one major one in particular, as I said, is the Baluchistan city of Gwadar. In April of 2017, Pakistan signed an agreement whereby the state-run Chinese company, the China Overseas Port Holding Company, would handle Gwadar port operations for 40 years. And as I mentioned, this is at their strategic choke point. It's very close to the mouth of the Persian Gulf. It's in a vital sea lane of the northern Indian Ocean. And it provides a link, as I said, to the base in Djibouti, which the naval base which China has established, but also back east. China also has military capability in Sri Lanka in the port of Hambantota. They're developing one in Myanmar, which is formerly Burma, and all this connects back to the South China Sea, where they're already establishing a number of artificial bases in that area. So it connects, it's a connection of the entire military strategy of China, which is establishes through these, you know, economic Belt and Road Initiative, opportunities, let's say.
This is particularly important because, as you say, China is exploiting these arrangements for military purposes. One of the ways in which they're doing that, of course, and you, the numbers differ. I'm not sure that anybody's got an absolute fix on this. You say 152 countries out of whatever it is, 195, are now hooked up in some form or fashion to the Belt and Road Initiative. But Lawrence, talk a little bit about the technique that the Chinese use. It's been called debt trap diplomacy, or financing for, you know, these projects. And what kinds of projects are now being put into place that when things go south, the military of China will perhaps own outright and certainly be able to exploit?
Yes. What China does is, unlike...
Besides the ports, I mean, you've talked about those. And that's an obvious place of concern.
Yes, indeed. The United States usually gives aid in the form of grants, for example, whereas China always gives aid in the form of loans. And they use these loans to build, you know, as infrastructure, basically. It's doing so in Pakistan in the terms of a transportation road network, but it also in Africa, for example, they built railway lines, and all of these are designed airfields, and all of these are designed to access natural resources. So, for example, in Africa, they want, of course, minerals, but also, you know, agricultural capabilities to help feed the Chinese people. China will now make an arrangement with the Taliban, which they've been negotiating with for a number of years, to exploit Afghanistan's $3 trillion of mineral wealth. In Baluchistan itself, it has
including, by the way, let me just ask you to digress for just a second. What kinds of minerals are there in Afghanistan, and to some extent some of the African countries as well, that are of special interest to the Chinese, not just for their value, but for their strategic significance?
Well, as you know, Frank, the Chinese already dominate in terms of strategic minerals. And in particular, in Afghanistan is really the Saudi Arabia of lithium. And lithium, of course, is an important component in batteries. So if you're looking for that type of energy, you know, electric cars and things like that, China will essentially own the market on lithium, own the market on batteries and the components of batteries, which you know, even if you want to argue about the Green New Deal, will depend on. So all these strategic materials, which are many of which are in in military hardware, which the United States needs, will essentially be controlled by China.
So what we're watching in the microcosm of South Asia and worldwide now, including, by the way, in our own hemisphere, are Chinese commercial operations that are clearly dual use in character, if not directly tied to and supportive of the People's Liberation Army, its Navy, its Air Forces, and so on. And what you have suggested in this paper and previous writings about Balochistan is a way to help screw that up, at least in this particular instance, and perhaps with a rather pronounced effect on China's ambitions more generally in the region. Just develop that a little bit further, Lawrence. What specifically are you recommending the United States government do at this moment?
Well, that's exactly right. If you look at the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, which is the flagship of the Belt and Road Initiative, it runs down through Pakistan, but in particular in Balochistan. So the Belt and Road Initiative, the economic portion of China's aggression, is dependent on them controlling Balochistan, but also, perhaps more importantly, the military aspect of Balochistan is important for China to succeed. Let me give you some recent information that I've just come across. Is that what is happening in Balochistan, especially in the Gwadar area, which is being actually fenced off? And the access is being restricted for a growing Chinese presence. And they're talking about up to 500,000 Chinese coming into the Gwadar area. And the naval and air base facilities are planned, are going to be put there. And again, that is at the mouth of the Persian Gulf. So they're controlling those vital maritime lanes. But in addition to that, there are discussions underway now in Pakistan to essentially divide Balochistan into a northern and southern sectors, and where selective areas of the Balochistan Arabian Sea coast would be reserved for Chinese facilities and operations, in particular military. So this whole coastline will potentially be militarized by China, because the reserving areas on what is called the Makran Coast in Balochistan on the Arabian Sea for Chinese development. So what needs to be done, in my opinion, is what I call strategic disruption. I mean, we need to, together with India, who's been involved in this previously, for example, to support the Balochistan independence movement and prevent China from capitalizing on the withdrawal of the United States from Afghanistan. So disrupting them by essentially supporting ethnic self-determination, not only in Balochistan, but perhaps in the Pashtun areas as well. Simultaneously, I think we need to recognize that Pakistan is the epicenter of Islamic terrorism in South Asia, and we need to address them with sanctions, for example, the financial action task force. They should be blacklisted and for essentially money laundering for terrorism. We know that that Pakistan has terrorist bases which attack India. So there's sort of the predicate for the taking those types of actions to prevent the success of China through Pakistan and the Taliban in South Asia. It depends on whether we have the will to do it.
One of the other considerations, and now that we're out of Afghanistan, those involving logistics and the relationship with the ISI and the military of Pakistan are definitely in a different light at the moment. But Lawrence, what we're always told is, well, we have to deal with Pakistan as a nuclear-armed state, one that is not only potentially capable of unleashing its weapons on neighboring India, as you say, but also of selling them to others and behaving very badly, perhaps even against, you know, our very vital interests. How do you respond to the idea that, well, this is all well and good to talk about supporting, you know, a sort of insurgency, I guess, in Baluchistan, when this seems to be the ultimate trump card, if I can use that expression, to suggest that under all circumstances, no matter what the Pakistanis do, no matter how badly they behave towards us and our interests and friends, we have to continue to sort of coddle them or maintain the fiction, I guess is the way I would put it, of a working relationship with Pakistan.
Well, yeah, I would think that the United States would have, and perhaps in coordination with India, would have some way of securing securing Pakistan's, you know, nuclear capability, because there's always that threat that occurs that terrorists might have access to Pakistan's nuclear capability. What are the alternatives in this case? If we continue to coddle Pakistan, essentially we will be coddling China. So I think we can do things that will, you know, keep it under any type of nuclear threshold in terms of covert action in dealing with ethnic self-determination or other financial or and sanctions that we could apply to Pakistan to essentially disrupt, because Pakistan is really the weak link in terms of the China-Pakistan-Taliban relationship. And I think if we focus on Pakistan diplomatically, economically, and to essentially subvert their ambitions in terms of the domination that China would like to have in the South Asian region, that would keep it at a threshold below, I think, we need to fear.
Well, from your lips to God's ears, I think is the case. I worry about, you know, the Taliban having their eyes on those Pakistani nuclear weapons. And there are those who say, you know, the commanders in the Pakistani military who actually have at the local level, in some cases, control over these weapons may be sufficiently jihadist in their own inclinations to be quite content to have these things migrate into the hands of the Taliban. I don't know, but this is something that argues for greater control over those weapons or neutralizing of them even.
That's why I say that probably the best thing we can do now is at least have a plan to neutralize them or secure them in such a way. And I think that cooperation with India in this case would be advantageous because exactly as you say, we don't know because a lot of these Pakistani generals are Islamists. And there have been attempts by Islamic extremists in Pakistan to try to get access to these,
including bin Laden for a time.
Capabilities. So yeah, you're exactly right. I think first and foremost that there has to be a plan to secure or neutralize them.
I presume that the Indians are all about that, but it's something that warrants our closer attention, and we appreciate that which you are giving to it, Dr. Lawrence Sellin. Let me pivot to another thing that you are giving close attention to, and I think extremely usefully so, and that is the degree to which the Chinese Communist Party is pursuing biological weaponry with growing evidence that it is designed for the purpose of attacking populations like ours, and doing so in a way that may not be fully discernible and could be quite devastating. Indeed, that there is evidence that going back to Deng Xiaoping's time in the early 1990s, when this program seems to have been kicked into gear in earnest, the object was to depopulate the United States so it could be colonized by China. I don't know if you care to comment on the larger purpose of this program, but give us a sense of its magnitude and tie into it, if you will, what we've learned about it all in connection with the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think everyone needs to recognize the fact that COVID-19 was made in a laboratory in China, because if you look at the structure of the virus itself, it's unequivocal. There are elements of that virus which simply could not have evolved in nature. And
now, let me just say, sir, you are speaking about this from the perspective of a trained, as I said, clinical scientist, I think with considerable expertise in virology, and you, of course, worked at Fort Detrick, the U.S. Center for Biodefense. So this is not just you're passing on somebody else's expert opinion. You have one of your own, and it's highly informed, I think it's fair to say.
Yes, I did work at Fort Detrick, and of course, Fort Detrick has been working on viruses for decades, and I'm very familiar. I've read literally hundreds of articles on COVID-19 and related viruses. And I can tell you for a fact, based on just looking at the structure itself, that it did not evolve from nature, was created in a laboratory in China. And it was part of a biological warfare program, because the characteristics of COVID-19 match perfectly with Chinese military doctrine. In this case, they're talking about a virus which is highly contagious but has low lethality, is like a debilitating virus to wear down an economy or wear down a society. And this is stated in Chinese military doctrine. The other very important thing about COVID-19, which is also in Chinese military doctrine, is the fact that it's a virus that can be attributed to nature. So it was specifically designed. So it was not clear, or the Chinese could argue, well, it came from animals, and therefore you can't blame it on China. So it is prototypical of the type of biological weapon that is described in Chinese military doctrine to begin with. Now, the extent of their program is massive. I've done some analysis of the structure of China's biological warfare program, and I can tell you it exists in three levels. The first is a core military level, which consists of strictly military research and military hospitals. Now, layered on top of that is a very important component of their program, which involves Chinese universities and so-called civilian research centers. And as we know, there's no difference between civilian and military research in China. But the Chinese military, the People's Liberation Army, uses that layer of universities and so-called civilian research centers, like the Wuhan Institute of Virology, to gain access to international expertise and technologies. And they've done that very effectively. Chinese CCP scientists, Chinese Communist Party scientists, and also People's Liberation Army scientists have been coming to the United States for three decades, and they've thoroughly infiltrated at many different levels the United States virus research program. So there's some of them are still working in U.S. research labs as we speak. Some of them are People's Liberation Army personnel, and they're still feeding and feeding back information from the United States, and in fact collaborating with People's Liberation Army scientists on China's biological warfare program. So we have a very big problem in the United States in that respect.
To be clear, what you've established with your research, Lawrence Sellin, is that quite apart from what Anthony Fauci and his various organizations and their funding have been doing inside China at the Wuhan Institute of Virology and perhaps in some of the other facets of the Chinese biological warfare program, which brought us, as you say, the COVID-19 virus. There is this other facet of Chinese research and technology development relevant to their purpose of, well, among other things, destroying our country with such weapons. And that is going on inside our country with their military scientists here in various research institutions, at least some of which is also being funded and enabled by Tony Fauci and similar kinds of U.S. government funding. Is that possibly correct?
Oh, it's absolutely correct. It's far worse than people realize. I'll just give you two examples. There's a scientist at the University of Texas Medical Branch in Galveston who was trained in China, and now he's a professor at the University of Texas. And just last year, he published a paper which was funded by Tony Fauci on what are called Zika virus, which is a much more dangerous class of viruses than coronavirus. And he was collaborating with the Wuhan Institute of Virology and included scientists from the People's Liberation Army. Now, this was published just last year. And this study involved gain of function research. So there's still gain of function research, which is enhancing viruses to make them more pathogenic and more infective. It's still going on. So that's one example. This is they're working directly with Chinese scientists who were involved in the biological warfare program funded by Tony Fauci's Institute at NIH. But also, if you look at the work going on in the U.S. Army in terms of biosensors and bioaerosol, there are Chinese trained scientists in those programs who are collaborating back with Chinese scientists in the mainland China. And some of them are connected to the People's Liberation Army. So not only are you creating viruses, but we're collaborating with people who can distribute those viruses as an aerosol, which has been suspected in terms of how COVID-19 might have the pandemic might have started.
Well, let's turn to that. I mean, this other piece of it is simply mind-blowing, I have to say, and is something that I really salute you for your research. You've actually, in the course of it, along with Dr. Li Mingyang, been able to identify by name some of these Chinese agents, scientists, PLA officers, whatever they are, in America. And it is simply staggering to me that they have not been sent packing. And to the extent that, to the contrary, they continue to have access, they continue to be doing research, they continue to perhaps be doing research on viruses, as you say, Zika virus, that is more lethal even than COVID. It seems as though this can only be ascribed to malfeasance on the highest order with respect to Dr. Fauci or, you know, others in their government who are allowing this to go forward. But, Lawrence, just to come back to the COVID story, how is it, as you see it, that this disease emanated from the Wuhan laboratory? Was it by accident, as we are told now, grudgingly, by people who previously told us it had nothing to do with the laboratory, it was the wet market, it was Fort Detrick or something else. But to the extent that you're satisfied that this was bioengineered, and it was bioengineered probably in that Wuhan Institute of Virology laboratory, probably with money from U.S. taxpayers footing the bill for the research, how did it get out? Was it intentionally unleashed through aerosol or other means, or accidentally, and then seized upon by the Chinese to disseminate it further through techniques like, you know, containing it domestically, but facilitating travel of personnel who probably had it in their systems internationally?
Well, Frank, I think there's at this point, and it's still a developing story, there's evidence to both support a possible leak and intentional dissemination of the virus in a test. Now, I have been in contact with a Chinese scientist who was actually on the ground in China during the initial phase of the pandemic. And this source was a friend of his, was one of the scientists who allegedly was involved with the People's Liberation Army in the planning of the release. And this source claimed through this scientist friend of his that the People's Liberation Army did a test release at the World Military Games in Wuhan at the end of October in 2019. And I've also been presently trying to get in contact with some of the U.S. athletes who were at that World Military Games in Wuhan who in fact, did get sick, and claims that the symptoms that they had are similar to COVID-19. So that is one aspect. And this particular Chinese scientist who was working in Wuhan and allegedly was involved with the People's Liberation Army, the deliberate release or test release, was also involved in exercises with the People's Liberation Army as responses to that type of infection, which in fact did occur. These exercises did occur prior to the Wuhan World Military Games. Now, it's also claimed that the Wuhan Institute of Virology was involved in testing the infectivity or transmission of the virus in the Wuhan University Animal Lab, which is a level 3 containment facility on non-human primates. And that is a possible source of the leak, because this particular facility is at the epicenter geographically of the pandemic. So, that's the other possibility, but we haven't got enough information to make a determination either on an accidental or a deliberate release yet.
Let me ask you to qualify this. I don't know that this has been said seriously or in facetiousness, but that a level 3 laboratory has essentially the protections of an average dentist office in the United States. Is that an exaggeration, or is that suggestive of just how derelict the Chinese are with respect to controlling these very dangerous pathogens?
The Chinese are notoriously sloppy in terms of safety in these virus laboratories. And so the P3 level, let me backtrack a bit. There are actually more than one Wuhan Institutes of Virology in Wuhan. There's a level 4 facility, which is a high containment facility, where allegedly the leak occurred, at least according to the various news items that are coming out now. But the test on the non-human primates could not have been done at that facility because they didn't have the capability or the Chinese license to conduct non-human primate studies at that particular facility. And that one is about 11 miles south in the center of the city. So they had another Wuhan Institute of Virology Center, which was a P2, P3 laboratory, closer to where the outbreak actually occurred in the Wuchang district. And associated with that was the non-human primate facility of the Wuhan University, which was a traditional center for non-human primate studies with viruses, and from which a leak could have also occurred. So there were two facilities at the epicenter of the pandemic during the earliest phases that could have been sites for this release of the virus.
And just to go back to where we think this may first have been unleashed, and again, this suggests deliberately unleashed, is these military games in Wuhan in, I believe it was September of 2019. Is that right?
The Wuhan games were at the end of October.
End of October.
Of 2019. Okay. So that puts it directly in line with how the virus spread, because the first reported cases were actually in mid-November. So it's entirely possible that the test release, and this is what the source in China claimed to me, was it got out of control, that they did this test release at the Wuhan World Military Games, in which some of the athletes there, both in Canada and the United States, became sick. But what happened was that test got out of control in Wuhan itself, and that's when the pandemic essentially started, with the first cases actually being in mid-November, which falls directly in line with what you would expect in terms of a release at the end of October and people getting sick after that.
Well, this is such a stunning development. As you know, Lawrence, the Chinese Communist Party has, through their propaganda outlets, suggested that your colleagues at Fort Detrick actually infected American military personnel participating in these games and brought them to the games. So if they were actually responsible for infecting some of our people, it also has to be said, it shouldn't be a surprise, but it is cheeky, to say the least, that they are so so cynical in their propaganda. But to this larger point, again, Augustus Dr. Lawrence Sellin, a man with considerable expertise in these matters, including a PhD that is directly relevant, when you look at this virus and what was its trajectory, are you familiar with this tabletop exercise called Event 201? The theory of this, and it's laid out in video of this exercise that is, I believe, still on the web, that the Chinese Communist Party's Centers for Disease Control were part of this game in which a COVID virus pandemic was modeled in terms of what good could come of it, in terms of enhancing, well, global governance, I guess, global agencies, including the World Health Organization and the like, and the, you know, Davos World Economic Forum and the Rockefeller Foundation, the Gates Foundation, Bloomberg's operations at Johns Hopkins University, and the Central Intelligence Agency, by the way, as well as our own Centers for Disease Control, were all party to this game. And I just wonder what you make of it. Is there any credence to be given to the possibility that if this didn't inspire the Chinese, that it nonetheless informed them about how this might be done, whether at the military games or elsewhere, to devastating effect worldwide, including in this country?
Well, there's been a lot of talk about population reduction and, you know, culling the herd.
Among other people like Bill Gates.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. Bill Gates has been promoting this. He was involved in this particular exercise. But the various exercises related to coronaviruses were occurring at that time. There was a military exercise in Wuhan Airport itself, conducted by the People's Liberation Army, which was participated by the scientists that I referred to earlier, who was allegedly involved in a deliberate release at the World Military Games. He was also involved in this exercise with the People's Liberation Army at the Wuhan airport, which was about the accidental release of coronavirus at the airport. I should mention also, you said that the Chinese Centers for Disease Control was involved in this. Well, George Gao, who is head of the Chinese Centers for Disease Control, has a long history of dozens of research collaborations with the People's Liberation Army. And one other thing, to go back to what you said earlier, we discussed earlier about the recklessness of what the Chinese are doing. It has been recently revealed that the Wuhan Institute of Virology had planned experiments, and again, this was connected back to the Fauci's funding and the EcoHealth Alliance of Peter Daszak. The Wuhan Institute of Virology was intending to take pieces of virus, like the spike protein, and essentially spray it inside a cave in China to infect the bats with this altered or genetically altered spike protein. So talk about the whole idea of recklessness and the whole idea of dispersing in the environment genetically modified portions of viruses or viruses themselves. They seem to have a history of at least planning to do that.
And in the process, one can only imagine, they are taking huge risks with their own population. And I guess this is one of the principal takeaways from any conversation like this about the Chinese Communist Party, is its utter disregard for the well-being of potentially many, many, many millions of Chinese. They've obviously murdered, by some estimates, 100 million of them outright, and maybe another 400 million of them in utero. But it's still staggering to see that they might deliberately infect bats, which would inevitably translate, presumably in due course at least, to loss of human life inside China itself. Lawrence Ellen, we have to wrap it up at this point, I'm sorry to say, but we could go on for hours more. There's so much that you have been exposing, among other places at Gateway Pundit. And I look forward to continuing our conversation with you in the near future. In the meantime, thank you for this generous time today, and Godspeed in the important work you're about. I know you'll keep it up. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow for more of Secure Freedom Radio. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
Joint Chiefs Chairman Mark Milley will likely excuse his contribution to Joe Biden's humiliating defeat in Afghanistan today by falsely asserting the Taliban's swift victory was unexpected. Even more untenable is our unpreparedness for the coming conflict with China. Its leadership and propaganda outlets have been telling the Chinese since 2019 that their country is engaged in a people's war with the United States and to prepare for hostilities. Former Air Force Commander Matthew Lohmeyer urges Milley's Senate interlocutors to ask, quote, did he tell his counterpart in the People's Liberation Army that in the event the United States government decided to engage in military-related actions against China, he would provide advanced warning? Unquote. If so, the general's conduct would not be, as with the Afghan defeat, merely a gross dereliction of duty. It could prove to be a devastating betrayal of our country. This is Frank Gaffney.
Night after night in cities across the country, black-garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
This is Frank Gaffney with a word about a truly great American patriot in urgent need. Rich Higgins served in the U.S. Army and as a key civilian Pentagon official and senior strategist on President Trump's National Security Council. After he left the NSC, Rich continued advising Mr. Trump and others about the threats we are facing from enemies, foreign and domestic. He chronicled his experiences over the past 20 years fighting for America First in a terrific memoir entitled The Memo. Now this courageous freedom fighter is gravely ill due to severe complications caused by the Chinese Communist Party virus. He urgently needs help to defray the enormous costs of successive surgeries and a prospective organ transplant. I urge you to join me in contributing to a GoFundMe campaign named Medical Help for Rich Higgins. That's Medical Help for Rich Higgins at GoFundMe.com. God bless you, and Rich Higgins.